I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Quentin Lucas will be sworn in as mayor of Kansas City, Missouri this Thursday. His race against Jolie Justice was not an easy one, and like so many elections, it took a lot of work behind the scenes. Today, a look at what that last week of the campaign was like. Local reporter Mike Mahoney was granted access to film Lucas on the campaign trail. Find out what it was like following the energetic candidate, and if there was a moment when Quentin Lucas knew the tide had turned. Then, a la carte medical shopping has risen in popularity, and it's now in Kansas City. It allows patients to search for care they can afford, hear what it offers, and if this is an alternative to health insurance. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Quentin Lucas becomes mayor of Kansas City on Thursday following his big win over Jolie Justice last month. KMBC political reporter Michael Mahoney was there with Lucas throughout the final week of his tumultuous campaign, and his Making of a Mayor special on that experience will air at 9 o'clock tomorrow night. That's Tuesday night on KMBC Channel 9. Mahoney saw things that no one else did, and he's here to talk about it. I'm a big fan of Mike's, and it's always great to have him here in the house. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. I'm a big fan of this program.
Good. Thank you. How did this opportunity to cover Lucas so intensively come about?
Well, literally, it was a lunch conversation with me and one of our photojournalists, and we were talking about the KMBC magazine special report series called Chronicle, and he said, Mahoney, you ought to do one of these. And I said, I have nothing to contribute. And he said, yeah, sure you do. And he pressed me on it. I said, well, you know, one of them, you know, if I could follow a couple of the mayor's candidates down the stretch wall to wall, morning to night, I might do that. And so he talked me into it. I went to my boss, Dan O'Donnell, pitched the idea. He embraced it enthusiastically. And then I went about trying to secure the campaign's cooperation on it. We asked the Quentin Lucas campaign. They jumped at it. Lucas, in particular, was very eager to do it. Huh. We asked the Jolie Justice campaign. They considered it, but they declined.
Why do you think they declined?
I think it's because the campaign was, like almost all campaigns, is risk-averse or was risk-averse to it, and they didn't want to be in a situation where they didn't know that they were in control of their message or in control of what the camera was going to see.
Even though this program was going to air after the election.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. And that was the ground rule that we explained to them was this is everything that we're going to shoot is going to be embargoed. It's not going to be part of any news process and daily coverage of the mayor's race or anything like that. It would be a separate operation. And the Justice campaign said thanks, but no thanks.
Having said that, you asked for unrestricted access, right? You wanted to be able to see whatever you wanted to see.
Absolutely. And we got it. We were in staff meetings. We had a camera photojournalist in the car going from point A to point B. We were behind the scenes in the prep rooms for debates. Mm. We were up on the rooftop of the old Wonder Bread building at 30th and Troost, where the Lucas campaign headquarters was, and they have remodeled the top of that building, so it's a nice giant deck is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. And occasionally they would go up there for discussions, and we followed them up there to debates, to campaign stops everywhere. In fact, one of the stops that we went to, and this apparently happened a lot during the campaign, either Lucas or Jolie Justice would go to what they thought would be a house party, and it would be a group of neighbors that went, hey, what about this creek down here behind my yard? It's washing out or something like that. Mm. And so the campaign stops turned into a city council constituent event, and that happened to both of them.
Why do you think Lucas gave you such unrestricted access? You know, as you pointed out, in this era when campaigns want more than anything else to control the message, to be in charge of what the public was seeing and perceiving about a candidate, Why do you think they gave you such incredible access?
I think it was in the nature of Quentin Lucas. In fact, the day that I pitched him on this, I met him outside of the Kansas City Star building downtown because we were going to do an interview. Hey, you're in the finals. Here we go. And I pitched him at it, and he went, yep, I'm a millennial. I'm all about this. And so he was – which is
true. There's something to that, yeah.
And that's almost a direct quote. And so he was with it from the get-go. I had to sit down with campaign manager John Stamm on a number of occasions, explain to him what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and that the ground rules was complete access. I also told him quite candidly, we're here to document the campaign. This is not a gotcha effort. If there's gotcha events in it, so be it. I used to use the example, look, if he's at the campaign office and he's beat tired and he takes a nap on the couch, well, I might show him taking a nap. Now, I'm not probably going to show him snoring loudly,
yeah,
okay?
Right,
as an example of that. Now, A, he did not take a nap, and B,
didn't
I don't
snore. Yeah.
And I don't know if he snores because we didn't see it. But
yeah,
it was to document the campaign, the stress on him, the stress on the campaign, and the development of there. We were not looking for dirt, but we weren't going to walk away from it either.
Well, let's give our listeners a sense of what you got here, because, again, the access is so remarkable. You got on camera, Mike, what seems like backroom discussions about financing, negative campaigning, and a whole lot more. Again, let's give our listeners some sense for this. This is a clip of Quentin Lucas talking money with his campaign manager, John Stamm.
Let's focus. Finish, all right? I've been listening to Marty Schottenheimer quotes lately.
I don't think we're running a Marty Ball type campaign. I think we're running the opposite of that.
If you look at our spending, we are.
They're probably terrified because they see that we have so much cash on hand. Like, what are we about to do with it?
Oh, we're just going to flood them.
We already did. It's already all gone. Yeah, we probably have about 12 to play with, but...
12 to play with, and then there's an extra 10 just sitting there.
I think. I mean, if you think about the campaign as a whole, 750 spent down to a $10,000 buffer, that's... percentage-wise, ain't bad, so. And then I think we should do more radio. The Jolie campaign is buying Google Search. They're not targeting the Kansas City. They got an ad for it in Boston, so they're wasting some of it.
What an interesting race, man. Who knew?
So the strategy here really was what you just heard. They wanted to flood the zone in the final days of the campaign. That was the strategy going in. It's what they did in the primary, I think.
Plus, the back half of that conversation, they started talking about digital advertising, and the Lucas campaign did a lot more digital advertising than they did conventional broadcast ads on
television.
Meaning
Facebook, Twitter, that kind of thing?
Facebook, Twitter, social media in all facets, and that when they talked about having some 40 different live looks up in terms of different messages, that it was that they had a variety of messages, and they would start out with a universe of somewhere in the range of 200,000 people who they thought were interested in the campaign, and when people would take a look at something on Facebook or a Twitter message, they would isolate that down, then they would send them another one, and the more that people clicked on that, the more the campaign responded. And so they had, as Stamm said in that clip there, more than 40 different variations about this as they narrowed and targeted their likely Lucas voter for the entire campaign, the entire general campaign.
You know, it's interesting you say they had all these different messages for people. You always read that the idea is to be consistent with like one or two points you want to drive home to a voter, but you're suggesting maybe the Lucas campaign went a different way.
They went after people that were most likely to be welcoming to their message.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went digitally drilling down, I guess is the phrase, looking for likely voters, corralling that group, and then continuing to send message and pepper them with their message.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. I'm visiting with veteran KMBC political reporter Mike Mahoney. He has a special called Making of a Mayor that airs tomorrow night. That's Tuesday night at 9 on KMBC Channel 9. That really got an inside look at the Quentin Lucas campaign as it headed down the stretch during the final days of the race. Jolie Justice's campaign declined to take part. You know, Mike, a lot of times sources act differently in front of a camera than maybe they would if the camera wasn't there. Did you get a sense that Lucas or his staffers were being careful around the camera? Were they tempering their words? What was your sense?
They were very, very aware and very sensitive to that. The difficulty with being that sort of sensitivity is you can't do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And
because you were there almost that much.
Yeah. We were there from the first event in the morning until they went home at night.
Wow.
The inhibition in front of the camera dropped quickly, probably dropped within the first several hours of it. And I became aware of the fact that with Quentin Lucas, in many respects, what you see is what you get. He's
not that different behind the scenes as he is in front of the camera.
Right. His language is a lot more relaxed in an informal situation. But he was pretty much the same guy. Stam, the same way. There was one incident where it just stunned me. I was at their campaign office, and I was typing up notes for that part of the day. And Stam texts me and says, "You need to meet me at the office. Mic me up. I have a fire to put out." And I'm going, okay, these animals are a little better trained than I thought they were.
Wow.
And so I said, "I'm sitting at your office. Come on over." And we were in the middle of what I'll call the shift change, where the day side photographer was wrapping up his day. The night side photographer was coming on. That changeover was going to happen there. The changeover took place. Then Stam walked in and began to show the field director a flyer that came out from a third-party group from St. Charles. This was on the Friday before the election, going after Jolie Justice. And Stam in particular was terrified about the fact that perhaps this flyer going after Jolie from this St. Charles group would produce blowback on their campaign after they had pledged and said repeatedly, "We're not going negative."
Mm-hmm. And how did that whole thing play out?
Well, we have a clip of that.
Do we have that next year? I think the next clip we got here is moment where Alicia Kennedy calls Quentin Lucas, and that her endorsement was really highly sought after. She finished third place in the primary campaign.
And the reason she was important is that she had a great grassroots operation in the 5th District, and she only finished, I believe, 3 points behind Lucas in the primary. Mm-hmm. And so her ability to marshal Alyssa Kennedy supporters was sought after by both of them. The other thing that took place was the Lucas campaign was intently interested in getting the endorsement of Heather Hall from north of the river, because she's very much a strong advocate of law and order and support for the police, and that was one of the key cornerstones of the Lucas campaign, is trying to reduce violent crime.
And did he get Heather Hall's endorsement?
I don't know, man. We gotta play the clip.
Okay, let's listen.
Got a call from Heather Hall, who's endorsing Jolie.
No, what?
Also got a message from Alicia. That's the not as bad news. And she's like, "Hey, we need to talk later."
Is she calling you right now?
What's up?
Is she calling you right now?
Is she? I can't hear anything because I'm deaf. Yep. It's Quentin Lucas. Hey, there, would you be interested in a formal endorsement? Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. All right, bye-bye. Oh, man, I hate politics.
Good.
I hate politics.
I'm so glad you made the ask. I was going to be like, "You better make that ask." Good.
And what's happening there, Mike, is they're high-fiving and slapping
and
palms and hugging because they just got the endorsement from Alicia Kennedy, a key moment in the race.
Right. They were talking about how they were going to deal with not getting Heather Hall, and lo and behold, Kennedy calls up at that moment and endorses, and they subsequently had a news conference, and they believe that was an important endorsement.
Now, give us a sense. You said early on you get a sense of the stress on a campaign, particularly in those final days when everything is happening at once. How much stress are these people under?
A pretty severe amount of it in the sense that, number one, time is running out for the campaign. Number two, as you just heard, they had concerns about whether or not they had enough money down the stretch to execute. They did. In fact, they had a little more than they planned on. And then the entire years worth of work behind a campaign is now dwindling down to a few days. And they went into that final weekend believing that they were in a very, very tight race.
And I was just going to say.
And perhaps an underdog. Now,
how
they
can
make
that be? He won big. 20, but we won by 20.
18, yeah. 18. They didn't see it coming. I didn't see it coming because I was pretty much submerged with the campaign. What I think happened was north of the river, the police and fire supporters up there came out strong for Lucas. The turnout in Clay County was only about 17%. It was an opportunity for the Northland to speak with a loud voice, not so much. Of course, the Northland also didn't have a candidate in that race either. And the Lucas campaign also thought that the Painters Union in particular just kicked out the jams for them, hitting doors, dropping flyers, that sort of thing. But down the stretch, as late as Monday morning before the election, Stam told the office staff in the final staff meeting, this is going to be neck and neck.
So that's what they thought heading down the street.
Yeah.
That's just remarkable. Did you ever get a sense they had a feeling that even John and Quentin, the two lead members of the campaign, did they ever get a sense this thing was turning in their favor?
They got confident at the end, but it was based largely on what they felt like they were doing digitally. They did not have much polling.
That's amazing.
But their sense of it was that their message was getting across, and in their individual contacts with voters, they felt confident about what they were hearing.
That could be so misleading.
Oh,
at the
my
same
goodness.
Time,
yeah,
know?
Yeah. I mean, we've got a clip in this doc from Jolie where she says, you know, we feel good about this. We like our numbers. We like where we are at on this, and that was on the Friday before the election. She still thought that they were in a nice position. They liked where they were at.
Were you with them on election night then as the totals began to roll in?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And when the Northland numbers came in, they came in first. Clearly, that must have been a breakthrough moment of great significance to them because they didn't win, but they didn't lose by as much as they thought.
Right. What they wanted to avoid was getting blown out
yeah.
by 12, 15 points, and that didn't happen. They lost Clay County by 2 points, and they felt very confident about being able to roll up numbers south of the river. They also were competitive in Platte County out there. And for everybody that knows a little bit about Kansas City politics, that was a big indicator right then that Lucas, A, wasn't going to get blown out that night, and B, that he was in the hunt. And then the numbers that came in from the 4th District, which was the home district for Jolie Justice, were also good for them. So they... When the numbers started coming in.
Those numbers come in earlier than the rest of the city?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Not Brookside, but Clay and
yeah.
Platte do.
Yeah,
And then the next big chunk of numbers that really sort of buoyed them came from the Jackson County precincts.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were waiting to see how the 4th performed, and they performed very well there. They performed well all over the city when you win by 18.
Again, you know, it's sort of old news now, but it's almost impossible not to appreciate just how far Quentin Lucas came. You know, he lost the primary to Jolie Justice by several points. You know, he was the clear underdog going into this thing, and yet he routs her by 18. It's a remarkable performance. Did he have any... clue as to why this happened? In terms of Mike, did he think on election night that at what point did he know? Just when the numbers came in?
Yeah, and at one point when the spread started to expand, he was watching the numbers coming in on TV and turned to Stam and some other members of the staff and said, "I think we can call this a mandate." But I don't think that they thought that was going to take place until that moment, they saw the votes coming in.
Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date with Mike Mahoney from Channel 9. Good morning.
Hi, Frank.
Mike, what was the most difficult or dangerous part of your assignment, and how much sleep did you get? I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah. How much sleep did you get, Mike?
I don't think that there was anything that was dangerous.
You rotated photographers. They didn't rotate reporters.
Well,
right? It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there were times when I was not there. I usually would peel off in the early part of the evening, 7, 7:30, 8 o'clock. The hardest part was we were at the Juneteenth celebration over by the Jazz Hall of Fame, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and it was a muggy, warm day, and he worked this crowd really hard, and I never thought that grip and grin session would ever end. I swear to God we were there 5 months.
Yeah.
But it was just it was physically hard that day in particular.
What did you learn about him that you didn't know before?
That he has an interesting frame of reference about 80s movies.
Really?
He would quote them all the time, and in particular one movie, Babe, the Pig. Okay, it's a story about
not the first movie I would have picked.
Well, yeah. Me either. Movie about this guy that has a exceptionally smart pig that he takes to fairs and it wins prizes. And apparently the pig, I vaguely remember the movie, the pig would do things sometimes showing off, and the farmer would go, "That'll do, pig, that'll do." And Lucas would say that from time to time to
whomever.
Anybody was around. And the first time I heard that, I almost fell off the chair. And he had some 80s movies cliches that he would drop in from time to time, and that just astonished me.
Did you get any insight into his relationship with outgoing Mayor Sly James? Melinda Henneberger from The Star has an interesting column today just about that relationship, and maybe it's not all that good. What insight did you get into that?
You know, actually very little. There was one telling episode where on election night when the Justice campaign was waiting for Mayor James to come down and join her. In fact, Julie made a reference about, you know, "I want to thank the man up there," which a lot of people would have assumed at the moment that it was a religious reference. Well, she was actually referring to the fact that Sly James was upstairs. And over at the Lucas campaign, when they figured out that they were waiting, the Justice campaign was waiting for Sly before they would concede, there was some frustration. But the rest of the time, they were so concentrated on their campaign. And the other thing, nobody was going to outwork him in this. He hustled all of the time.
He is everywhere at once. Say what you will about Quentin Lucas, he is everywhere.
Yeah. And that was on vivid display during that campaign. He worked hard.
So as you look down the road here, he'll become mayor. First full day is on Thursday. What's he going to do first, Mike? What's at the top of his to-do list?
Number one, finish fleshing out his staff, naming a council pro tem, which will probably happen pretty quickly after he's inaugurated. I think he says his inaugural speech will be like his campaign in the sense that it will be positive, and that he will try to explain how to pay for some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. He has three big issues that will not produce results very quickly, even under the best of
crime, circumstances. Housing, and infrastructure,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, to use the old cliche, an ocean liner. They turn around very, very slowly.
Which makes you wonder, it's an interesting issue set he's taking on here. Change desperately needed, but as you point out, not instantaneous results here by any stretch.
Yeah, no question about that. And I think that the mindset of the voters on this election in June was they wanted change. And let's see how much rope they give him, what the patience is of the voters.
Okay. Mike Mahoney will join Mayor-elect Quentin Lucas for Making of a Mayor at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Library 6:30 Wednesday evening. Again, the special airs at 9 o'clock Tuesday night on KMBC Channel 9. Mike, always great to have you here. Fascinating story. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Everybody tune in.
When we come back, we're going to talk about a new way to shop for healthcare. It's called a la carte medical care. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, we got recommendations from our friends, the film critics, that range from dark comedy to a Netflix documentary. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Greg Eklund is back along with two sports photographers for a look at what it takes to capture fast action in a still photograph. Join us tomorrow for that conversation on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, a few months ago, ago, we talked on this show about direct primary care. That's a new innovation in healthcare where consumers pay a monthly membership fee for access to their primary care doctor. It's a step away from insurance. Now, a look at yet another innovation in a healthcare field that's changing rapidly. It's called a la carte medical shopping. And in this model, consumers buy healthcare the same way they might buy air flights or hotel rooms. They can do it online with upfront pricing. A new website that deals with a la carte medical shopping has launched in Kansas City, with its first, which is its first home city. The new services put the consumer in the driver's seat and make them active participants in the care they receive and how much they pay for it. Critics raise questions about the quality of care. With us here to talk about these new services, Michael Botta is co-founder of Sesame. That's an a la carte medical provider now operating in the Kansas City area. In recent months, the site has priced teeth cleaning plus x-rays at $29 and $79 for a 60-minute MRI. Michael, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I appreciate it.
Arthur Kaplan is head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center in New York. Arthur, good morning.
Good morning.
Ralph Weber is the past president of MetaBid. That's a service that involves submitting a request for what you need done, then allowing doctors to bid on the service. He's also a healthcare policy consultant who's worked with presidential candidates Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani. Ralph, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ron. How are you this morning?
Professor Kaplan, let's begin with you. What's going on out there? I mean, we've got a la carte medical shopping. We've got doctors bidding on services. Has a new world order descended on healthcare here?
I'm not sure a new world order has descended across healthcare yet, but it's got its foot in the door. So we definitely have internet connectivity. We didn't have that 20 years ago in the way we can today with social media and the ability to, you know, even see somebody through telemedicine who's not in the office and that sort of thing. We have more and more people complaining that they can't get to primary care, can't get an appointment, can't find someone in their town, maldistribution of frontline caregivers, too many specialists. So in a sense, the market is responding to that and starting to say, hey, we could get you in to see some versions of primary care. Expensive, things cost a lot. People are trying to find ways to bring down the price of visits and services. And some people are saying, we think we could do it more cheaply. So a lot of combination of factors to try and deliver, I'm going to say mainly primary care, diagnostic care more cheaply using, if you will, our new internet capabilities.
Michael Botta, let's talk about one of those new capabilities. Give us the two-sentence explanation for what Sesame Healthcare is.
Sure. So Sesame at its core is a website, so people can go to sesamecare.com and see it. And fundamentally, it's a platform where if you're looking for an appointment with a doctor or a test like an MRI or an X-ray, you can see actual availability, so doctors in the Kansas City area that have some time open on their schedules, and how much they'll charge you upfront. So you can pay through the website for a prepaid price, lock in your appointment time and that amount, and then see a doctor and not get a bill afterwards.
Well, why did you launch this service in Kansas City? Why not Baltimore? Why not San Francisco?
Sure. Yeah, great question. Kansas City, pretty representative of the whole country. We had some existing relationships with physicians in the Kansas City area who were interested in practicing medicine a different way. It's interesting, the American Association of Family Physicians is actually based in the Kansas City metro, so there's lots of discussion among the family medicine community about what's good about practicing medicine when you take insurance and deal with all the challenges there, and what some alternative models are. You mentioned direct primary care. There are quite a few docs who practice medicine using that model in the Kansas City metro as well.
And just finally, Michael, where did the idea for this come from?
So my co-founder and I, David Goldhill, were looking at some of the overarching trends in healthcare over the years. And one of the things we noticed was what it means to be insured in America has changed quite a bit. So it used to be if you were insured, you saw a doctor and the bill went to Cigna or Aetna or Blue Cross.
Right.
And increasingly now, every year, your deductible for many people goes up. So the amount of money that you have to spend out of pocket before your insurance really kicks in and starts paying the bills, that amount has gone up. It used to be $200 or $500. Now it might be $1,000 or up to $5,000 if you have a plan through the Affordable Care Act. For some families, that can be up to $12,000 or $13,000. Hmm. So increasingly, there were people who had insurance but found that they were paying their medical bills themselves. So they really cared how much their healthcare would cost them, but they didn't have a good way to compare prices and actually shop around.
Ralph Weber, let's turn to MetaBid. What is MetaBid and how does it work?
Well, we work primarily with employers, but also with some of the state health plans, and we've been contacted by Medicare as well. In a nutshell, we're an online portal, which is automated, allows a patient to make a request for medical care. Doctors and hospitals respond with a bundled price for that episode of care. And what you see is you see their training, education, experience, their outcomes, their quality, and very often they will respond with a request for more information, such as if you have an x-ray uploaded to the portal. And sometimes they will respond with a second opinion. They'll say, I've looked at your x-ray and I'd like to start with a consult, or maybe an arthroscopy is more appropriate than a full knee replacement, but I won't know until I get some more imaging studies.
And
so
what this
Mayo
means,
Clinic has proven that 88% of the time when a patient gets a second opinion, the initial diagnosis.
Are you there, Ralph? I think what this means, just to cut in here while we try to regain a connection with Ralph Weber, is this idea that if you want to get a knee replacement, you put that request up online.
Got kicked off. Sorry.
Okay, you're back here. And doctors from really across the country can bid on, if I need a knee replacement, Ralph, they can bid on that. And then I might be traveling to Provo, Utah to get my knee replaced, right?
In some cases, we always offer a local option because people like to stay local. But most of our patients are looking for the best quality provider, which does sometimes mean traveling. And because they get that second opinion built into the bundled price and they see the quality of the provider up front, they can often see a better way by driving 2-3 hours or, you know, hopping on a plane.
So in MetaBid's case, you don't submit claims to a patient's insurance company. I mean, why not?
Well, we work with employer groups that have third-party administrators. Usually they're private TPAs, but sometimes they are TPAs that are operated by Blue Cross, Aetna, you know, Cigna, et cetera. So the claims follow the general same process as they do right now, where they, not insurance company, but the administrator is billed directly for that patient's care. Because sometimes the options are more cost effective, we will waive the deductible or out of pocket costs, and we guarantee no balance billing. The bundled price is the bundled price.
Ralph, how does a patient know that the doctor who submits the winning bid, in this case of MetaBid, is actually, you know, a good doctor who knows what he or she is doing?
Well, because we vet them, we take a lot of time. We start with checking their license. We look for complaints, allegations, malpractice suits. Then we look at the regular sites, LeapFrog. We look at the CMS data when it's available, health grades, vitals, RateMyMD. So we take a lot of time looking at the quality, which isn't always available through the traditional insurance model. Generally, all you're able to see is whether that physician is in network. Some of the insurance carriers don't even verify that their license is active and in good standing and that there's no malpractice suit. So you see a lot more in terms of quality. What we've also drawn is an inverse correlation between cost and quality very frequently, where the experienced surgeon is able to do the surgery more efficiently in less time. That means less OR time is billed, perhaps fewer nights in the hospital. So it ends up costing less, lower risk of readmission or hospital-borne infection.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about new innovative ways to access healthcare different than the traditional fee-for-service going through your health insurance company to get that care. If you want to join our conversation with a question, you're welcome to do so. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Professor Kaplan, you know, how big a concern is the quality of care for both of these services, Sesame and MetaBid? What should consumers be thinking about here?
Well, it is a concern, although I don't mean to say it's not a concern in the traditional insurance or in-network systems, too. We don't really have great information for anybody. Some of the things like LeapFrog or other certification agencies don't really get down to the micro level of how well this stock is doing. You also sometimes want to buy reputation. So if you want a knee replacement, there are big hospitals that want the business and they drive the business toward them and they do a lot of procedures. And what they're saying is we have a good reputation. You can't necessarily go doctor by doctor to see someone like me at my age with my, say, bum knee. How have they done particularly with people like me? But quality is a major issue whether you're bidding on it or having the doctor bid to you. It's a weakness in our healthcare system overall, I would say. There are also liability issues. If you do fly to Provo, Utah to get your knee replaced from Kansas City, are you going to be suing in Provo or Kansas City? If something goes wrong, who can you go after? Can you go after the parent companies?
Right.
How's that whole area of malpractice and legal liability work? Who's going to be responsible if things are not done properly, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have the traditional issue that's always out there when people are bidding on the internet. It is possible sometimes for people to just leak through and, you know, kind of not tell the truth and mm-hmm. scam their way around as they move from state to state or place to place. You're always wondering, again, not unique to bidding on services, but it's still a concern. Am I going to get what I paid for?
Michael Botta, what about that?
Sure. So one of the things that's been interesting to us since starting Sesame is really how do you measure quality? How do you measure safety? I know it's interesting to David, who's our CEO. So a few folks mentioned LeapFrog. David actually is chairman of the board of LeapFrog, so he's been thinking about this for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Art, which is to say that traditionally in healthcare, we haven't done a very good job of measuring safety and quality. And that's true for the healthcare system as a whole. One of the things that we hope, I know it's something we hope at Sesame, and I think, you know, I'm sure this goes for Ralph as well, is that by having some of these internet-connected platforms to find care, we can start doing a more effective job as a healthcare system of measuring quality and measuring outcomes. So one of the best proxies we have right now for quality of care before, let's say, a procedure is done or you see a doctor is honestly just how many times have they done that thing. So mm-hmm. if you're getting a knee replacement, there's no real easy way right now to find out if I go with surgeon A or surgeon B, who does this most frequently. You can dig into the Medicare data. You can hopefully ask them questions and see what numbers you can pull up. But by having platforms like these, one of the things we think we can do at Sesame is give you that information right up front and show you this person does this more than anybody else, you know, on the Sesame platform. This person's in the top 5% or 10% of volume for these procedures, and increasingly be able to measure things in that way.
You know, Arthur Kaplan, again, head of the Division of Bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center in New York. You know, speaking broadly here, there's been a need for patients to be more active consumers when it comes to the cost of the health care they receive. Do I have that right? And does these steps get us a step in that direction?
They could help. They absolutely could help if they do deliver more information about quality, if they get you to be more willing to go to a primary care person in particular and not delay your care because you're thinking, oh, you know, I'm not really going to get this tooth fixed until it really is aching and you wind up with a much worse situation. Our mainstream healthcare system, the traditional model, basically is good at rescue and trying to give people therapies, not very good at prevention. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who are probably thinking, I don't have money to do any of this. What's out there for me? I'm not quite in the Medicaid boat, but I got three kids and I can't fly to Provo, Utah, and I'm not sure I can spend all that much time on social media. So isn't this a little bit boutique-y? Isn't mm-hmm. it something, these models that will really only help, you know, sort of the better off?
Yeah. Ralph Weber, again, president of MediBed. How many doctors participate in MediBed here in the Kansas City area?
I don't know specifically about Kansas. We have 28,000 in our network. Those are the ones that are actively bidding right now. I wanted to touch on something that Art Kaplan just said, because
Please.
It's hugely important. 40% of Americans cannot afford $400 for needed medical care, so they put it off.
Mm-hmm.
And if you Google that exact phrase, it'll come up a million times. They define affordability of a health plan where your deductible is less than 5% of your annual wages, and your out-of-pocket maximum is less than 10% of your annual wages. Mm-hmm. Most health plans don't fit that criteria. Sometimes by getting a procedure at a lower cost, our employer groups, and we have employers ranging from 50 employees to 80,000, the employer will actually waive the deductible and pay the travel costs. So their choice is staying local, and I'm in Houston, so local might be Memorial Hermann or you're a Methodist, mm-hmm. and then paying $5,000-$6,000 deductible and out of pocket, or maybe going to San Antonio and having that waived. So employees are actually able to get medical care from a quality provider, often a better quality provider than normal, by doing that.
Michael, I'm wondering, with Sesame, I'm wondering what kind of interest you've received from the Kansas City area in your product in Sesame.
Sure. So going great so far. So just here in Kansas City, over 170 providers, of whom over 100 are physicians. The others are dentists or physical therapists or other healthcare providers. And they're offering real upfront prices. So if you go to the website and you're in Kansas City, you can see actually what it would cost you to see a cardiologist or see a dermatologist or see a primary care doc, or to get an MRI if you've been to the points that Ralph or Art made. If you got a diagnosis, you know, a few weeks or a few months ago, but you called around and you found out that the price was going to be $2,000 or $2,500 to get something taken care of, mm-hmm. you might find that because physicians that we're working with on Sesame have some open slots, like even a great surgeon, even a great specialist gets 2 to 3 cancellations a day. So if you're looking to fill that time and you're a physician, a platform like Sesame is a great option for you because you can say, okay, here's an upfront price. That this platform is where people actually are congregating if they need something in the short term. So let me use that.
You know, Michael,
we've seen that work so far.
There is something a little counterintuitive here about this whole conversation, which is, you know, the idea of driving down the cost of healthcare. A lot of folks out there think the more you spend for healthcare, the quality is only going to be better. And I know both of you guys, Michael and Ralph, you guys dispute that. But that there is that mindset out there. How do you counter that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure if you know, I'm a health economist by trade. So if I think back to the PhD days, you look at the research and you can see in the research, there's no real connection between the price of a healthcare service and the quality of it. You can get just as good of an MRI for $400 as you can for $2,500. It's often the same person reading it at the end of the day. So, but you're right that it's very difficult to counter that perception because in healthcare so frequently, there isn't anything else to go on. There isn't good information about right. quality or safety like we were saying before. So one of the things we're hoping to do is include, and we do this already, include ratings from customers. So patients who have seen an individual physician so you have a better sense of what quality of care was like. Include some of the other information over time I mentioned like volume. So how often does a given physician see a patient for a given condition, et cetera. And be able to build on that over time to give people more information than just the price. Because I think what we see is in the absence of other information, the best signal we have is that price. And you can only mm-hmm. assume if something is more expensive, if you don't know otherwise, that it's better.
Hey, how soon do you plan to expand beyond Kansas City, Michael?
Very soon. This week, actually, we'll be live in Wichita. And then beyond that, are going to expand to some additional cities mm-hmm. over the coming months in the Midwest as well.
Yeah, and one more thing, Michael, and I wanted Ralph to pitch in here too. Help me understand this. What's stopping doctors from using this as a money-making scheme, you know, sometimes performing surgeries that aren't always necessary?
Yeah, great question. I think what we see is, to the point that Ralph made as well, we're doing a lot of work to validate these physicians for their quality of care, for their safety record, and having things like reviews can give people more insight into what was service like with this physician? Did they give me advice that made sense to me? And Steve, the problem you point to, I think, is a real one for the healthcare system in general, because we put a lot of trust in our physician. Mm-hmm. We assume that they're going to do what's best for us. And we often have a very good way to validate that or to know that necessarily what they recommended is the best course of action. So mm-hmm. we're hoping that platforms like these can help give people more information to act on.
Ralph, what would you throw in there about MetaBid?
Well, I'd like to address all three issues. Quality, what we have found is there's almost always an inverse correlation. Let's compare two knee surgeons. One does 500 a year, one does 5 a year. The one that does 500 is going to be very efficient, half an hour in the operating room, and the operating room bills by time. Mm-hmm. The anesthesiologist bills by time. And if you're only under for half an hour, you don't have to stay overnight for observation. The inexperienced one might take 2 hours. more OR time, more anesthesia. And if you're under anesthesia for 2 hours, they will keep you overnight for observation. So more expensive procedure. That's the first thing on quality. We find that the time of year that you make a request, for example, on Expedia, if you're booking a flight from Kansas to Orlando tomorrow and the flight is half empty, you're probably going to get that ticket for $86. If there are three seats empty, it could be $800. Doctors are busiest the last 3 months of the year because people are through their deductibles mm-hmm. and they don't have time. In February, March, April, May, when they have an abundance of time, often their bids come in lower. So it's actually market forces that are starting to work. Now, regarding the unneeded surgeries, great question.
Right.
If under the traditional model, you are referred to one doctor and told that you need a knee replacement, chances are he's just going to do it. When you have potentially dozens of doctors bidding and some of them saying, no, you don't need one, that gives you, the patient, a little bit more information. Then you start to question it. And then you say, you know, maybe I don't. Maybe I just need physical therapy or an arthroscopy.
You know, Dr. Kaplan, you know, after promising to get rid of the Affordable Care Act back in 2017, President Trump sort of famously said nobody knew healthcare could be so complicated. You know, it seems like these days a lot of doctors are fed up with the bureaucracy of insurance agencies and are switching to these more modern healthcare options. So I'm wondering, why is it that the American healthcare system is so dang complicated?
By the way, I would have to say, I think the president was wrong. I think everybody who's ever been a patient or a provider in the system knows it's really complicated. It's mm-hmm. a swamp. So having said that, I'd say a couple of things. There is a lot of vested interest in not changing the system. There are a lot of folks making a lot of money. It's hard. What are we spending? Trillions on healthcare in the U.S., way more than any other country. Tough to move that aircraft carrier, which is sailing in a particular direction, you know, stasis is, you can explain it by, we don't want to give up the money we're making. I think there's some belief that, you know, in the U.S., the market can still be used to solve things, although I have my doubts about whether a pure market is ever going to get there. The current mess of extraordinary prices and lack of access makes me doubt that.
Right.
And I think there's been, I think there's been some price gouging. There is some greed in healthcare. If you can get away with it, say, on the cost of drugs, people do.
Okay, we'll have to leave our good conversation there. Interesting stuff, interesting options. That was the voice of Arthur Kaplan, head of bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center in New York. Michael Botta joined us. He's co-founder of Sesame. Ralph Weber, president of Medibid. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
KCUR's Up to Date is coming soon to your inbox. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up for our weekly newsletter. It features exclusive stories from me and the rest of the Up to Date team. It'll arrive in your inbox every Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up for your weekly dose of me. Wednesday on the show will be live from Linwood, Kansas, just 2 months after an EF4 tornado ripped through the small town, to see how recovery efforts are going. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.